Current State wants to extend an invitation to all of you to join us tonight at Schuler Books Okemos starting at 6 o'clock. We want to meet you. We want to hear what's on your mind and talk about how we might create segments on this program that include what's on your mind, okay? More of this, less of that. It's just about that simple, and we look forward to it. That's tonight, 6 to 8. Even if it's just for a few minutes, please join me, producer Joe Lindstroth, executive producer Peter Wharf, Schuler Books Okemos, tonight 6 till 8. Constructive criticism always welcome. If Okemos is out of your way and Eastwood Town Center is more convenient, well, we'll be there in a week from tonight. Same routine, 6 to 8. So join us, and we'll be continuing these community conversations, if you will, at other locations around town in the future. So watch this space. In the meantime, you can always communicate with us via email, currentstate@wkar.org. At the top of our program today, for about 5 years, Michigan's medical marijuana law has authorized doctor-approved patients either to grow pot or to buy it from state-certified caregivers. Now, the state legislature is looking at a second approach. Last week, Republican Senator Roger Kahn, a physician, proposed that in Michigan, marijuana goes from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule II drug. That reclassification could lead to medical marijuana becoming available in pharmacies. Kahn and other supporters say that would better ensure safety. Opponents say it could be an effort to corporatize marijuana and eventually even undo the 2008 voter referendum. East Lansing Senator Gretchen Whitmer sits on the Senate Government Services Committee with Senator Kahn. She joins us now to talk about that proposal and other capital business. Welcome back to Current State.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Senator Kahn seems to be saying that in Michigan, medical marijuana isn't medical enough. Is that a good way to look at it?
Well, I think that Senator Kahn is looking to expand the ability for, medical marijuana to be made available to people in the state of Michigan. You know, one of the misconceptions, though, I think about his bill in particular is that it relies on the feds changing marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule II, which means acknowledging that there is a medical purpose for marijuana. So he's written this bill to create pharmaceutical grade and permit corporations to come in and do the research and make this available to patients in the event that the feds do that. So this is a bill that's written based on a contingency happening at the federal government. And so I think it's created a lot of ambiguity for patients what this means. But at the end of the day, we need to wait on the feds to change this from a Schedule I to a Schedule II before any of this really becomes applicable to Michigan.
Now, this proposal passed the committee last week without your vote. Why did you abstain?
Well, my fear is that it's created a lot of ambiguity. You know, we had one group testify in favor of the bill, and then we had 2.5 hours of testimony by patients who are frustrated with the system that we have in Michigan. You know, Attorney General Bill Schuette has interpreted the law and closed down dispensaries across the state, and it's really created an access problem for patients who have, you know, a legitimate need for medical marijuana. We've authorized it under the state law by amending our Constitution 5 years ago, and there is so much ambiguity that patients really are struggling and they're frustrated. So they saw this bill get such a quick introduction and hearing, and they came in to testify as to what their problems are with the current law. And one of my concerns is that we're not addressing the access issues that patients currently have in Michigan, but yet we're going forward on a bill for a contingency in favor of, you know, a business. And so I think that there's a lot of room for us to start talking about marijuana in Michigan, and this doesn't promote that conversation.
What would you recommend? Do you have a particular recommendation that you're behind, that you support, that you think would be a more productive way forward with this?
Sure. Well, I think that there legislation has been introduced. A number of bills have been introduced that I think we should give at least the same amount of consideration to. And one was introduced by a Republican doctor in the House, Dr. Colton, who introduced a bill to make the dispensary process available and create more access. It's not in agreement with Bill Schuette's interpretation of the law, and so what we need to do is change the law to create better access for patients. That's something that I think we should be talking about. Another is perhaps it's time for Michigan to have the conversation about decriminalizing marijuana here in our state. You know, last week we saw three more communities move forward, Lansing, Jackson, and Ferndale, moving forward with decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana within their cities. I think that that's a conversation that's long overdue. And if you look at the polling, the legislature is behind the times, not surprisingly on this issue as we are on many, but that's perhaps a conversation that and a debate that we should engage in.
How is the quality of medical marijuana determined now in Michigan? Or is that simply not nailed down to the degree that it should be?
It's not nailed down. You know, currently we permit providers, you know, people that have been authorized to grow small amounts of marijuana for their personal use or for patients, but it's very small amounts and it's not something that is controlled quality-wise by the state.
Some opponents point to support of the bill by the company that is the sole supplier of medical marijuana in Canada, that's Prairie Plant Systems, and they worry that if bigger companies and pharmacies get involved, that it may even threaten the 2008 law, which does allow, as you say, certified individuals to grow. Are there still pieces of this you're considering then? You've referred to ambiguity several times. There's arguments on both sides that you're weighing.
I think that that's a legitimate concern. You know, in Canada now they've got one provider and it is this particular company. They've taken it out of the ability for patients to, you know, to grow their own medical marijuana. And I think that even though under this bill we would have two different ways of patients having that ability, ultimately the fear that they would take over the whole growing side of the equation is something that I share their concern. It's about access for our patients.
We're talking with East Lansing State Senator Gretchen Whitmer here on Current State. Let's switch gears to the Court of Claims proposal on Governor Snyder's desk in Sunday's Lansing State Journal. You wrote, Senate Bill 652, quote, might be the most brazen political power grab I've ever seen in my 14 years in the legislature, unquote. Would you consider some more limited reform that would regionalize the Court of Claims more and remove the focus on Ingham County?
No.
Or is it invalid from the get-go?
I think it's invalid from the get-go. I mean, this is a system that we've had in place since 1978. It was a bipartisan reform. Representative John Engler at the time voted for it. Governor Milliken, Republican, signed it. The rationale for making the Court of Claims in Ingham County is because it is the seat of government is Ingham County, and it was convenient because the Attorney General's office is a party on all of these lawsuits. There was a big cost savings involved because of the convenience here, and so the move by the Republicans and the governor to take the Court of Claims out of Ingham County is completely political. It's not about cost savings. It's not about convenience. It's not about justice. It's completely political, and that's why you've seen newspapers across the state pan this idea, whether it's the Free Press or the Lansing State Journal or the Battle Creek Inquirer or even the Detroit News, who is a pretty right-leaning publication, have all called on the governor to veto this overtly partisan legislation.
Even the news piece, though, you mentioned the Detroit News piece, which I noticed as well. Even the news piece did recommend that the governor veto the measure, but that they advocated that the legislature create four geographical regions and a blind draw of judges to avoid the possibility of cherry-picking judges. At the heart of their case, I think they still seem to suggest that 3% of the state's electorate should not be electing all of the judges that decide cases against the state. Is there anything to that argument?
It might have merit, and I certainly would be eager to engage in that type of a dialogue. The problem here is that there is no dialogue going on. This is a bill that was introduced, it was passed through committee, it was passed on the floor. Before it even went over to the House, the Ingham County Circuit Court judges were told to pack up their cases before it was even introduced in the House. And so that shows you that this was a fait accompli before it was even introduced.
Who issued that order? Do we know?
They were instructed to start packing up their cases before the sponsor of the bill even could tell us, does it apply to pending cases? The sponsor didn't even know what his bill did.
This is Senator Rick Jones.
Senator Rick Jones couldn't have told you if it applied to pending cases or not. Now, of course, we know it does apply to all the cases that were pending. 333 was a number that recently came out of the court. Pending cases somewhere in the process of litigation. So you can't tell me this is about cost savings because they've just taken away all of the work that has been done on each of those cases and they have to start from scratch. You can't tell me this is about convenience because the Court of Appeals doesn't even have witness boxes where they can swear people in for the purposes of testimony. They've asked the Ingham Court if they can use their courtrooms. I mean, this is overtly political. And the question is why? Why? Is it because there are so many cases about the governor's nerd fund pending in the Ingham County Court?
You would say yes.
Is it because that there's compelled testimony on emergency manager cases in the Ingham County Circuit Court?
Is it?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the governor and the Republicans why. But I suspect that there could be a very causal connection there and that they want to pick who decides cases against them, and that's not justice. That's stacking the cards to benefit yourself, and it's taken away people's right to challenge their government when they feel aggrieved by what's been done.
Are you aware whether the governor may be reconsidering his support of the measure?
He has said in a number of publications when asked that he plans to sign this bill. I'm surprised he didn't take some time out of his weekend to sign it because I think they're pretty eager to do that.
That's one of the reasons I asked the question is that there is a little bit of a delay here before the governor is signing it. But you have no indication that he's reconsidering his support.
I have no indication. I would certainly hope that he wouldn't sign the bills, but you know, his early indications were that he intends to.
A new Senate committee, Compliance and Accountability, will be looking into the compliance of Michigan teacher unions with the new right to work law. Your spokesman, Bob McCann, referred to this as a political witch hunt. What makes it a witch hunt?
Well, because when the Republicans see teachers as a party to a lawsuit, they want to create a whole nother layer to look into this. When the Republicans see their own governor as a party to the lawsuit, they change who decides the case. This is two different systems of government based on who you are in the state of Michigan. You know, the rule of law is that no one is above the law. We should let the court system play out on every case, and the legislature should not get involved, whether it's adding a greater burden or alleviating the burden for their own friends. That's baloney, and it's offensive to me as a lawyer, and it's offensive to me as a lawmaker, and as someone who is a citizen who ultimately wants to know that I get my day in court and everyone's treated the same under the law.
The Mackinac Center Legal Foundation is representing 8 MEA members, or former members, I'm not clear to tell you the truth, in a complaint against the teachers' union, saying their efforts to stop paying dues were not handled properly. Have you looked into that? Does that case have any merit in your view, to the extent that you followed it?
I don't know if it's meritorious or not, and that's why it should have its day in court. You know, my suspicion is it's politically driven because it's the Mackinac Center getting involved, and I think you can always question what their motives are because they are an overtly political organization. But I do think that everyone should have their day in court, and that's exactly what I'm saying when I say we don't need a special committee to add another burden here, and we don't need to give the governor his own hand-picked judges to decide his cases. Everyone should have their day in court, and it's important that the citizenry knows and has faith that our judicial system works. And all of these efforts, I think, undermine that, and it makes me fearful as a lawyer, as someone who has a great reverence for the law and great respect for it.
You're one of four quadrant leaders. You're referred to the leaders of both parties for both the House and the Senate in Michigan, along with Representative Grimal, Senator Richard Ville, and Representative Jace Bolter. What have you been discussing lately, and how often do you meet?
Well, you know, I would say in the governor's first year, I think we'd met twice. In his second and third year, probably in combination of seven or eight times. The bulk of the meetings have happened in very short period of time relatively recently, and we focus a lot of energy talking about transportation. We do have a meeting scheduled this week, and that, I'm told, is the subject. I don't know much more other than that what is on the table for our discussion, and even if I did, I don't know if I could tell you, but I don't yet.
Well, I have to ask, are they productive? Are they generally productive meetings or not?
Well, I think that they can be. And I am an optimist by nature. I never would have run for political office in the first place. I will say, though, that when you have this overtly partisan agenda being rammed through and stuffed down our throats here in the legislature and on behalf of the citizens, that it undermines our ability to find common ground. You know, that happened with right to work. Governor took a long time before we even were trusted one enough to have meetings, much less try to find some common ground on issues. And this Ingham County court issue with the Court of Appeals, I think, is the same type of thing where it undermines our ability to find common ground when you find out how overtly partisan the agenda is on behalf of the governor and the Republicans. But I try to go open-minded into all the meetings, and we'll see what happens. We've got big issues that we need to solve for the people of our state. And so much time we focus on these ugly partisan issues, it takes away from our ability to solve those ones that we need to find common ground on.
Our guest has been Democratic East Lansing Senator Gretchen Whitmer. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Its current state on WKAR. Reports, predictions, and warnings of climate change are hard to avoid these days. But just how are Americans processing all of this news? And what do we really think about climate change and our environment? Well, MSU alum and director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, Anthony Lizerowitz, explores those questions in his research. He'll be giving the lecture on Climate Change in the American Mind. That's the name of the lecture. Climate Change in the American Mind, this Friday here in East Lansing, and he joins us now by phone. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to Current State.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about this. You get to study Americans' perceptions about climate change. What have you learned?
Oh, that's right. And so basically, one of the most important things we've learned, of course, is that while we talk about the American public, there really is no such thing. And in our work for the issue of climate change, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas, that basically you can take the American public and divide them into six very different types of people that each respond to this issue in very different ways. And that's really important for helping to understand why this issue is responded to in the way that it is, with some people who are deeply engaged, very concerned about the issue, others who are very kind of apathetic and not really sure what's going on, and then others that are just dismissive of the issue entirely.
So six different attitudes, you're saying?
Yeah, six different types of Americans, essentially.
Okay. Are there any things that all these groups have in common? Is there anything they agree on?
When it comes to the issue of climate change, not really. You see the wide variety. So at one end of the spectrum, we have a group we call the Alarmed, who are people who are convinced it's happening, human-caused, think it's a serious and very urgent problem. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have a group that we do call the dismissive. And they are convinced equally that it is not happening, that it's not human-caused, that it's not a serious problem. And many, in fact, think it's a conspiracy. They say it's a hoax or it's scientists making up data. It's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty and many other such of beliefs. So there's not a whole lot of common ground, at least in the way that they talk about climate change.
Are there geographical dynamics in play here? I mean, can you generalize about, say, Midwestern attitudes toward climate change?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, what we find is that these six different types of Americans are everywhere in the country. So you'll find all six groups in Topeka. You'll find all six groups in San Francisco. You'll find all six groups in Michigan. But they'll be in different proportions. So, for instance, in the Midwest, we may find more in the middle groups that are what we call cautious or concerned. You know, think that, yeah, this is probably happening, but are still trying to figure out what this is. Are humans really responsible? How serious of a problem is it? Whereas, say, in California, you'll find many more of the group that we call the alarmed. And then, of course, in some states like Oklahoma or Texas, you'll see a higher proportion of the dismissive. But again, you'll find all six groups in all of these different parts of the country.
Nationwide, Anthony, do the percentages in each of these six groups change much over time? Do you measure them often?
We do. We conduct national surveys twice a year, and we've been tracking these six different groups since 2008. And yes, there have been some changes over time. Basically, and this is all just out beyond the six groups, just the broader trends. Basically, 2007 was kind of a high water mark for public engagement with the issue of climate change. And since then, we saw a pretty dramatic decline in public beliefs about climate change, concerns about climate change, that kind of bottomed out in 2010. And then since then have been coming back up, not quite back up to the level of where they were in 2007, but on the way back up.
I'm flashing on the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth. Did that have anything to do with the high water mark being in 2007?
It was part of that time period. So 2004, 5, 6, and 7 was kind of this ramp-up period. And yes, Inconvenient Truth was part of that. But there was a major report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There was a Nobel Prize given to that body of scientists as well as to Al Gore. There was the Academy Awards. You had Arnold Schwarzenegger out in California taking pioneering action and kind of thumbing his nose at the Bush administration. You had a lot of things happening in that time period, and it all kind of crested in 2007.
We're talking with Anthony Leiserwitz, who is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. How could your findings be used to help scientists better communicate climate change information to the public? Is there a takeaway there?
There is. So one of the things that we spent a lot of time looking at is what do Americans really understand and misunderstand about the causes, the consequences, and the potential solutions to climate change. So there's lots there in terms of helping people better understand just what are the basic facts of this issue. But one of the most important things that we've learned along the way is that currently only about 4 in 10 Americans understand that over 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is happening and human-caused. And this is a really important misunderstanding that, in fact, most people don't understand that. In fact, the scientific community, just like the medical community, has long ago been convinced that smoking causes all sorts of negative health implications. Likewise, the climate science community is overwhelmingly convinced that this is happening in human-caused and will have a whole range of serious consequences, both now and in the future. And so that misperception of what the experts actually think turns out to be a highly consequential misperception. And it's really important that the scientific community do what it can to help people understand those basic facts.
Why does public opinion matter as part of the bigger picture?
Oh, Americans, of course, play a hugely important role in this in lots of different ways. I mean, first of all, we all are part of this system. We all use and conserve energy, both at home and on the road. Secondly, we all consume energy. We all consume certain products and services that have all kinds of consequences for how much carbon emissions are ultimately emitted. There's the way that we talk about this issue and the way that it either becomes a national priority or, as it currently is, something we don't talk about very much. And then last but certainly not least is the role that Americans play as active citizens. Both supporting policies that will be needed to be implemented, but also being willing to vote for leaders who are going to take those actions. And then even beyond that, some citizens actually becoming active citizens, using the tools of democracy to actually demand change from the political system. So in all of those ways, Americans play a really important role in addressing this broad problem.
You explained that the six different attitudes range from alarmed on one extreme to dismissive on the others. Just for the sake of completeness here, could you go through the other four?
Sure.
Do you have one word descriptions of each of the other categories like that?
Yeah.
What are they?
So the first group, again, is the alarmed. That's about 16%. Then a group we call the concerned. That's about 26%. Then a group we call the cautious, about 25%. And they're kind of sitting on the fence, not really sure is it happening or not, or human or natural, still making up their mind. A group we call the disengaged, 5%. A group we call the doubtful, 15%. And then last but not least is the group the dismissive, who are about 13% of the country.
Okay. Very interesting. And you conduct research twice a year on this?
That's right. We conduct two nationally representative surveys a year, one in the fall and one in the spring. And in fact, we'll have our latest results within the next few weeks.
Is it fair to say that views, political views, become a part of people's identities, their personalities, and that people resist new information that might threaten that identity? I mean, you would seem to have a unique angle on that dynamic. Is there something to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do, in fact, find that. And there's a broader psychological principle called motivated reasoning, that when people have deeply held, strongly held, emotionally held, and related to their identity, views about a particular issue, they become very prone to basically looking for any evidence that basically reinforces what they already believe, or ignoring or discounting any evidence that seems to contradict what they already believe. And we know that this happens certainly at both ends of the spectrum of these global warming six Americas. So just to give you two quick examples, and that's the weather. When the tornado takes apart, you know, Joplin, Missouri, as in a few years ago, we heard some people in the alarm category saying, aha, look, there's global warming, when actually there's no known scientific link right now between climate change and tornadoes. Plenty of links between other extreme events like droughts and heat waves and so on, but not tornadoes. But on the flip side, you had major snowstorms like Snowmageddon and Snowpocalypse a few years ago, and you had people on the dismissive side who would say, aha, look, there's no global warming because there was a big snowstorm. Well, that's actually wrong, too, because, of course, there is no inherent contradiction between climate change and large snowstorms. That's entirely consistent with the basic phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they jump on that to say, aha, that proves what I believe. So we do see that process happening at the extremes, but it's the groups in the middle who are the vast majority who are actually still open, still trying to learn what is this and what does it mean for me.
Very interesting stuff. I'm reminded of the description of why people expose themselves to the media they expose themselves to, and it's affirmation versus information. People gravitate to media in order to have their own views really affirmed rather than to be exposed to different points of view. This is the motivated reasoning you're talking about.
Well, we study media as well, and you do see that phenomenon, this kind of echo chamber effect. But there are also plenty of other sources of information where people do come with an open mind. I assume that this program itself is one of those places where people come to actually learn about important and often controversial issues happening in the state of Michigan and come to it with an open mind. So I think we do have those opportunities, but sometimes we have to look for them.
Well, we certainly try, Anthony. We want to thank our guest, Anthony Leiserwitz. Anthony is coming to East Lansing to talk more about what we've been talking about here today. He is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Anthony, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Arts Council of Greater Lansing has a new executive director. Debbie McCullough has replaced the departed Leslie Donaldson. Donaldson left Lansing a few months ago to become director of the Interlochen College of Creative Arts. She left big shoes to fill, and we welcome Debbie McCullough to Current State to tell us about her plans for promoting the arts in the Lansing area. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in. Let's learn a little bit about you, Debbie. You earned your bachelor's degree from Michigan State, the Department of Theater.
I did.
And your career includes 9 years as executive director of the Michigan Association of Community Arts Agencies, formerly of Old Town Lansing, by the way. Just like the Arts Council, what happened to the Michigan Association of Community Arts Agencies, and what have you been doing since then?
Well, we the Michigan Association of Community Arts Agencies was very similar to the Arts Council, but we were a statewide organization, and I think that the economics of funding decreases within the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs started us on a conversation to look at our organization and a very similar organization called ArtServe Michigan. And after 9 years of producing programs, capacity building programs for arts and cultural organizational professionals, and doing advocacy work, we decided that a merger of the two organizations would be very appropriate during kind of the downturn of arts funding. Mm-hmm. I ended up being kind of the architect from MACA's standpoint to pull the two organizations together, and spent about a year after the merger with that organization, and then was invited to work in my hometown. And so I decided that was probably a good move for me, 5 blocks from home. And I was the director of the Howell Area Parks and Recreation Authority for about 5 years. So I'm back in Lansing and feeling good and back in the arts.
You're replacing Leslie Donaldson. What does it mean to be replacing her, and what's on your agenda?
Well, you know, replacing Leslie and I have been friends for many, many years. Leslie was actually one of the board members for the Michigan Association of Community Arts Agencies, so we had a dynamic relationship in that respect. And she does have very big shoes to fill. She laid a very strong foundation for the Arts Council, and that was at a time when the Arts Council was kind of moving from being a facility owner to more of a resource and a capacity building organization for the artists and the arts organizations. So a lot of the from the Center for the Arts, that money went into helping to build the strong foundation that we have right now. And we now have 6 or 7 programs that are investing in artists and arts and cultural organizations and the professionals that run those. And we grant out a significant amount of dollars to help build programming and to create works. So we have an individual artist grant and the Ingham County Hotel Motel Fund. We have the Sense of Place grants through the City of Lansing. We are the re-granting agency for the Capital Region with MCACA, which is the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Is dispensing that money to the best of your ability, is that job won, as far as you're concerned? And if it isn't, what is?
You know, that's one section of it. You know, our mission is to lead, advocate for, and advance arts and culture in the Capital Region. We are not a producer of art. So we're not creating a festival, and we're not creating we don't have a gallery, and we don't have shows going on. We're helping to build the capacity of arts and cultural organizations to build their foundation, so their fundraising, their marketing, their staffing, their HR structure, all of those things are part of our work. So our programs and services really are about how to get them, 120 arts and cultural organizations and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of individual artists, how do we get them to be better organizations so that they can produce all of the wonderful art that, they brainstorm about?
We're talking with Debbie McCullough, who is the new leader of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. Talk to us about the training opportunities offered by the Arts Council, because making a living as an artist has more to it. There's more to it than just the raw talent. There are the skills needed to survive in the marketplace.
It's about
you play a role there.
It's about business. It's about being a good business. Even if you're an individual artist, you have to be a good business person. So we have something called our SMARTS program. And SMARTS is about helping to create some workshops and some panel discussions so that our audience, our customers, our base of individuals that are a part of the organization can come and learn better skills. So we are about professional development, and part of Thursday, actually, is one of our sessions for the SMARTS program. It is called Meet the Press. And we are helping the organizations and individuals who are going to attend that session to give them tips and techniques from the experts, you, and from others, the media, to help build their skills in getting the word out about their own programs. And sometimes it has to come from individuals that have a better knowledge base, more expertise. And we're looking to kind of build that based on, you know, where we go with that.
Is it hard to get artists to think more like business people? I mean, there would seem to be a gap there that for at least some number of artists.
Sometimes. I mean,
they're artists because they're artists. And you know, making that transition sometimes is challenging.
It's challenging because artists want to think, they think very creatively, and they want to do their art.
Of course.
And the other part of their work is the boring part, is the part that, you know, sometimes gets lost in the shuffle. You know, billing clients, getting the word out that you have a exhibit going on. Sometimes that's where I think where we can help, and we can, while we also fund individual artists for their creative work, we're also to help build their capacity to be a better business.
Does your background in theater play out in your new position?
Absolutely. You know, I somebody asked me, well, what have you done in theater? And I've done some work in community theater after I got this degree, but my work after I got my degree has gone to, I went up to Manistee, Michigan, and was the executive secretary for the Manistee Civic Players, and I got to direct a little bit, and I got to work behind the scenes. But really, that was the last place I really used the real theater skills that I learned, and started to look at. I looked at historic theaters because the Ramsdell Theater up at Manistee is a beautiful historic theater, and I loved that aspect. And then I started to look at. I'm really an arts administrator. Mm-hmm. I like producing and I like stage managing. So that took me kind of into the role of just. Leadership
in
arts and cultural organizations. And I like the whole concept of capacity building. So that kind of led to all of the work that I've been doing since then.
Last spring, the Lansing School District laid off more than 80 certified art, music, and physical education teachers in its elementary schools. The Arts Council is playing some kind of role here in the way forward for the Lansing School District. Can you talk to us about that?
A little bit, and again, I've just dipped my toes into the waters at this point.
Understood.
So three weeks in, but the Arts Council believes that there's a benefit of arts education, advocates for access for all students, and there's a role for the Arts Council. We are a facilitator and a convener of individuals that have an interest. And expertise in arts education. So we're bringing this group of individuals that have a passion for arts education together to talk to us about how do we take what we considered back in March more of a crisis and something that we advocate for. How do we take that and make it an opportunity? Mm-hmm. And the opportunity is to make sure that everyone is sitting at the table. We're growing that table of individuals that care about this, parents, the school administration, the arts and cultural community around Lansing.
Is that a short-term goal, is getting as many people at the table as possible?
Everybody together, let's figure out what we can all do. What role do each of us play in helping to move this forward? And moving forward, what I mean by that is there are short-term goals. The short-term goals are convening this group and finding the process to get to the long-term goal of bringing back the certified art specialists within the Lansing School District. That's our end goal. It we understand the financial constraints and we're of the school district, but what we're looking for is our long-term goal. It might be 5 years down the road. It might be longer than that. But we're looking to make sure that we're focused in on getting certified art specialists back into the elementary schools.
Might you reconsider that long-term goal over the years? Could you reevaluate that? I mean, could the dollars just not be there to make that possible 5 years from now?
Yeah. I think everyone has to invest. And everybody has budget shortfalls. The Arts Council is just not, I mean, we're not working off of, a heck of a lot of money. And the school district obviously has financial shortfalls.
Of course.
And the arts and cultural organizations who are now, that the school district is now looking toward to kind of take on some of this, they don't have the kinds of resources either. The Arts Council's role is to facilitate then that conversation to where else can we look for dollars that will support the Capital Region and arts education within the Lansing School District?
Debbie McCullough is the new Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. Thank you and good luck, Debbie.
Thank you so much.
Travel adventures, culture shock, and honest conversations are all topics brought up in a new documentary that follows four American students, one from Michigan State University, and four Chinese students as they travel through China. The film is called The Dialogue. It was created under a unique partnership with Crossing Borders Education and Michigan State University. It'll be submitted to international film festivals worldwide, but not before its screening tonight in East Lansing. Here in the Current State studio today to talk with us about The Dialogue, Dawn Pisarczyk, the coordinator of the project here at Michigan State, and her colleague Peter Briggs. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
We've given our listeners a brief synopsis of the film here, but Dawn, could you give us a little bit more detail on what happens in The Dialogue?
Sure. This is a film that MSU has been involved with in terms of the conceptual development as well as the technical development with Crossing Borders Education, as you point out. It really is, it follows a journey, and that journey is a journey of intercultural development and competence. So we follow individuals who do not know one another through this whole process of trying to learn about one another, to learn a lot of the cultural values, the mores, the norms, to the point where they can have various types of conversations about topics, whether it be Sino-U.S. relations or the economy or whatever, and then come to some understanding from their own cultural perspectives in terms of what some of the conflicts are and how do you resolve those conflicts.
Mm-hmm. You don't shy away from conflict in The Dialogue. We see it quite a few times in the film. We have a clip. Let's listen to it.
Mm-hmm. I don't intend to offend you. And actually, I feel that Some of your opinion really deep seems offensive to us.
Can you, give an example, at what point you feel that my comments is offensive?
I don't know. Maybe it is related to your personality, something too much critical. I don't know how to say it.
So we've got two Chinese students there conversing. Peter Briggs, what do you make of that encounter?
Well, I think any type of relationship has dynamics in it, and just because it's intra-Chinese doesn't mean they don't have their own sets of conflict and ways to manage relationships. And so we can talk cross-culturally. It gets even that much more complicated. But they were talking about their own stylistic differences, and that's what comes out in this.
Well, what's captured there, I think, is China is a society undergoing an unbelievable, profound change. So there's apt to be all kinds of conflict between the people, between the Chinese, and that's what we're hearing there.
Well, and we see it here on campus, too. We have a significant Chinese community here, and think of your own experiences maybe if you've been abroad where you see another American and you can either say, they gravitate towards my countrymen, or you're fleeing from them because you're embarrassed by them. And I think the same thing happens as they are here getting to know each other, and they have their within-country conflict, too.
Mm-hmm. Dawn Pisarczyk, how and why did the dialogue come about?
Absolutely. Well, MSU, being the very large international university that we are, with a substantial portfolio in the international arena, we do a lot of things with our study abroad programs, with our numbers of international students coming into Michigan State. We provide internships. We provide service learning and a variety of different experiences by which our students can gain intercultural or cross-cultural competence, as we call it. And MSU, through all of the work of its faculty, have actually developed cultural or global competencies that we aspire for our students. So this film actually maps to those cross-cultural competencies that we hope that our students will graduate with. And so this film then became kind of a catalyst to pull a lot of that content together, particularly for students who couldn't go outside the United States for study abroad or what other kinds of experiences. We give them an opportunity to have an intercultural engagement through film, through the medium of film, watching this whole process of intercultural communication actually develop before them, and have an opportunity to experience all of the issues associated with it, the challenges, but then the rewards that come from a successful cross-cultural communication.
We're talking with Michigan State's Dawn Pisarczyk and Peter Briggs about the documentary The Dialogue, with a screening tonight here in East Lansing. Is there a memorable moment from the film that you could share with us?
There is. The film has so many deep points to it that you know, as we watch it over and over and over again, I get something new out of it every time I actually watch it. But one of, I think, the real aha moments and the takeaways was when one of our American students was interchanging with one of the Chinese students. And she was, of course, speaking in English to this Chinese student, English being the Chinese student's second language. And she didn't realize it, but she was being somewhat impatient when the Chinese student wasn't answering right away. And so finally the Chinese student says to her, "You are so impatient with me. I am trying to understand your question. I'm trying to interpret it into Chinese and then develop a response to you, which I then have to deliver to you in English." And it was a real aha moment for this American student, thinking about the privilege of language. And she said, "My goodness, I never thought about that. That I perceive that you didn't understand what I'm saying. You're actually going through the process of a second language."
Yeah. Talk to us about MSU's partnership with Crossing Borders Films.
Well, it started with the goal of trying to bring attention to how hard it is to communicate across cultures. This isn't anything that's easy. So we met at a conference, and we had a common goal. And we were doing it in a variety of ways at MSU, and we've done it for a very long time. And this is what the filmmaker was trying to also achieve. We were a good partnership for intercultural communication issues, and that's how it started. And from there, it was a long journey to go back and forth and understanding who's going to do what and what levels of all the process.
I take it our growing Chinese student population played some kind of role in this, or not?
The role of China is almost incidental in the film. The goal of the film has to do with the challenges of communicating across cultures. And it took place in China and the Chinese, but the bigger picture is communicating across cultures. We're still new at this. It was only 100 years ago that airplanes brought us together across the world, and cultures coming together, we're still learning our way for how challenging it is.
The film will be shown tonight at MSU. Remind us where and when.
Yes, it is the Kellogg Center Auditorium. It begins at 6:30. We'll have a screening of the film, and then we have a wonderful panel, kind of multidisciplinary panel that's comprised of educators, but also community business leaders, to talk about some of the key content that comes up in the film. And so we'll have that discussion that will follow the film, and also invite the audience to give their reactions to a variety of scenes that actually occur and play out in this whole process that we're actually trying to demonstrate.
That's tonight, 6:30 at Kellogg Center. We've been talking with Dawn Pisarczyk and Peter Briggs of Michigan State University. The new documentary is called The Dialogue, and it's off to international film festivals after its screening here tonight. Best of luck, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that Current State invites all of you to join us tonight at Schuler Books. Starting at 6 o'clock, we want to meet you. We want to hear what's on your mind and talk about how we might create segments on this program that you would like to hear, include what's on your mind. More of this, less of that. 6 o'clock tonight, Schuler Books Okemos. We'll do it a week from tonight at Schuler Books in the Eastwood Town Center. We hope you can join us. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're joined by new members of the East Lansing City Council. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features Hope, an organization which provides deer meat to those in need. That and more Wednesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.